And now for the main message, our pastor, Mr. Steve Buchanan.
Understanding coronaphobia is. It's actually the title of an article published in the Asian Journal of Psychiatry in September of 2020. And I'll read just a bit from the abstract of the article. COVID-19 research and media reports have revealed a rise in fears related to contracting the virus. Though fear is a common psychological outcome during pandemics, the COVID-19 pandemic is a continuously evolving disease outbreak and has unique risk factors. Therefore, fear related to COVID-19 might manifest in not only fear and anxiety related to disease contraction and dying, but also associated with socio-occupational stress. I think if you put those words together and understand what that means and how it affects the workplace, you can easily see how that has been a major influence in the world today. The authors continue, we attempt to understand the psychosocial process of the development of coronaphobia, they've even given it a name, coronaphobia, and postulate what constitutes coronaphobia, a new emerging phobia specific to COVID-19. Well, I think most people are aware of what a phobia is. You know what arachnophobia is, right? Fear of spiders. You know that some people fear being in large crowds. And there are fears of all kinds, and they have given names to virtually every kind of fear that has presented itself to mankind. But a phobia is an anxiety disorder characterized by persistent, excessive, unrealistic fear of an object, person, animal, sometimes insect, maybe spiders aren't considered insects, but anyway, I'm not clear on that, or just forget. Animal activity or situation. Phobia makes people avoid the triggers of fear when such avoidance is not possible. It causes anxiety and distress. So by September 2020, and this is many months ago now, September 2020, in what we would call now the early stages of the coronavirus pandemic, how much worse would it be even now? But in September of 2020, a review of medical journal databases revealed that 500 studies had been completed on COVID fear. 500. How many would there be now, over a year later? 1,000? 1,500? Who knows? But they have actually documented that. Various components and outcomes, continuing on with the study, various components and outcomes of COVID-19 fear have been reported, such as functional impairment leading to hopelessness, suicidal ideation. You know what that is? That's thoughts of suicide, people contemplating suicides. And in fact, during this crisis, during the shutdown in many nations, there's been an incredible increase because of social isolation and lockdowns. There's been an incredible increase in death by suicide. I'm on Twitter and I read what some people say. You don't have to follow everybody on Twitter, but most of the time when I follow somebody, they're very conservative. But one mother talked about dropping her 9-year-old off at school. And of course, many schools and many jurisdictions around the world require youngsters to wear masks. And as she was getting out of the car, 9 years old, she said to her mother, she said, "I hate wearing this stupid mask all day long." She says, "I hate going to school. I wish I was dead. I am so sick of this world." Now, that is a real emotion expressed by a young person, and it mirrors what has happened to a lot of young people. And if this goes on and on and on, what are going to be the repercussions associated with young people who may have spent most of their lives having to wear masks going to school? But at any rate, suicidal ideation and coping deficits, fatal cognitions leading to association of COVID-19 with terminal end, and anxiety and depression while coping with the new normal. The new normal is not normal. It is totally abnormal. A phobia is an extreme or irrational fear or an aversion to something. Question. Has an irrational fear, not a rational fear, but has an irrational or an increased, elevated, unexpected, or wrong fear of coronavirus developed in the world in the last 2 years? I think most people would say yes, indeed. In addition to the emotional trauma that has been caused by the response to COVID-19, many other health issues have been neglected because people have been sequestered in their homes. They haven't had other health issues taken care of. Regular checkups have been denied, and maybe not with you, and maybe not with your circle of friends, but when you expand this out over millions of people and hundreds of millions of people, they have been able to determine there have probably been more deaths as a result of all other types of diseases that have accentuated because people just simply haven't been having checkups. Now, a lot of people would say, oh, that's kind of ridiculous, but it's really kind of documented. You can't argue with the facts. Has a mass psychosis developed in the world? Well, there does seem to be an increase in thanatophobia. That was a new one on me. Thanatophobia. Do you know what thanatophobia is? Everybody's looking up on their phones. Fear of dying. Fear of death. The actual death rate associated with COVID-19, even with some of the inflated death rates, which maybe I'll get into or not, is about 1%, maybe a little bit more than what the seasonal flu has been year by year, but affecting some age groups at a much higher percentage than others, especially folks over 75 years of age, a much higher death rate. Across the board, over all age groups, maybe a little bit more than 1%. And that's any rate of death is too high. I think we would all agree on that. And I'm not diminishing the death rate associated with COVID. Please don't get me wrong. But for those from 1 to 19, virtually non-existent. I mean, now have there been deaths? Yes. Throughout millions and billions of people in the world, 7 billion people in the world, there have been kind of a handful that they have documented as due to COVID for that very young age group. Same thing for 20 to 35, maybe 45, a little slightly higher, but across most of age groups, a 98% recovery rate. And that does nothing, of course, for those in that 2%, that 2 or 1.5 or 2% overall, or 1% or whatever it is, It does nothing to assuage the grief of anybody that's lost a loved one due to COVID because of that. But there's been such a focus. My point is there's been such a focus on this one cause of death that other causes of death have been virtually ignored. I mean, you don't see or hear of it very much. Now, you can research it. Sometimes your research will discover some interesting things. Sometimes it's not as easy to research things as it was on the internet years ago for various other reasons. But fear is a part of this whole thing, and it's been going on for nearly 2 years now. Fear is something that is a part of the coronavirus pandemic. There is something that has been identified as coronaphobia. And you've probably seen it yourself. Maybe it's been a part of your life, too. I don't know. But you've probably, at least if it hasn't been a part of your life, then you've probably seen it or been exposed to the abnormal fear of contracting coronavirus in many different ways. You probably see it every day. You're getting to be used to it as you go out into society, as you go out. And all of us have to go out, and we have to go out shopping. We have to fill up our cars with gas. highly inflated prices. Wasn't like that about a year ago, but now it's much higher to do so, but that's an aside. But we're subject to an elevated fear of death from coronavirus. And I was kind of shocked even when I began to do the research to find that the authors of this study, now it was done almost over a year ago, a little over about 14 months ago, that they completed this study in the very early stages, and they admitted that there is a phobia about coronavirus death that is abnormal relative to the danger that it actually presents. Does that make sense? I hope it makes sense. So, if not, then we're lost. You're lost throughout the rest of the sermon. I'm going off on a tangent that you'll never understand. The title today is Conquer Fear. I have a feeling that this is not the end of coronaphobia or any other phobia associated with disease. And one of the interesting things that just a student of the Bible that I have, you know, maybe tumbled onto is the difference in how I thought maybe 20 years ago how Bible prophecy might unfold as to how it actually seems to be unfolding. In other words, circumstances that we read about in Matthew 24, Luke 21, Revelation, and the various chapters never really contemplated 25, 30 years ago that they may be coming to pass as a result of man holding his foot out and then actually blowing off his toes, in actuality, actually doing it to himself. So I knew that we would always be subject to the problems that we create ourselves, but I didn't realize how drastic it might be. The title is Conquering Fear, and just a few simple points on how to effectively deal with fear, because we're living in a world that, let's face it, is somewhat overcome with coronavirus phobia, coronaphobia. And fear is a constant in the world today and in the future until the return of Jesus Christ. It's going to be something that we're going to have to deal with. Just want to equip you with a couple of things today that will be helpful to you in dealing with a world of fear, because I don't think that we're going back to some other normality of, you know, when we evaluate the world and what the world of the future is with Jesus Christ's return and the setup of his kingdom, there is nothing about this world of since the time of Adam and Eve that has actually been normal. But we get used to a kind of a normal. And if you're hoping to go back to that kind of normal, maybe I'm not the only one that is telling you this, but I have a feeling that we're not going back to that time and place of maybe January 2020 or November of 2019 or anything else that you thought was normal. There is I hate the term new normal, but it is abnormal. Everything has been abnormal. From the time of our birth, everything has been abnormal in this world, just that we've grown up and accustomed to it. Now we're subject to a really drastic change, and I don't think it's going to go back, but I hope it would. It'd be great if it did, in one sense. I mean, for the state of mind and the peace of mind of many of my friends and family. But there are a couple of passages in the Old Testament that speak about the future of the tribes of Israel. You know what they are, Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. Let's take a look at Deuteronomy 28 and whether this is entirely prophetic for the time of the end or whether it was intended for the next few hundred years in which Israel would become a nation and only applies to that time. I don't think it just only applies to that time, but I think that prophecy is dual in many cases. But notice chapter 28 of Deuteronomy and verse 65. Deuteronomy is a restatement chapter prior to the tribes of Israel going into the promised land, prior to their ability to accept the nation that God was going to place them in. In verse 65 of Deuteronomy 28, it says, "And among those nations you shall find no rest, nor shall the sole of your foot have a resting place, But there the Lord will give you a trembling heart, failing eyes, and anguish of soul. Now, this is after the first part of the chapter gives a recount of, you know, if you do this, you will be blessed. But if you don't do this, then you're going to have curses, and they're going to multiply, and they're going to get worse and worse and worse. So the latter part of the chapter is, or the latter part of chapter 28 is talking about the results of disobedience toward God to a people that were given the law of God and had the law of God. Your life shall hang in doubt before you. You shall fear day and night and have no assurance of life. In the morning you shall say, oh, that it were evening. And at evening you'll say, oh, that it were morning, because of the fear which terrifies your heart and because of the sight which your eyes see. So Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28 are chapters that parallel one another, and they outline blessings for God's people, obedience, and cursing for disobedience to Israel. One of the topics that I've covered, at least I think extensively in my little newsletter, is the fact that trying to identify the people of the tribes of Israel in modern day. Now, for people that have been around the church for years and years, it's kind of an understood thing. You know where these people landed in history. You know who they are, and you know in the time prior to Jesus' return, you understand who the tribes of Israel are. You know that, for instance, a very simple thing that escapes most Bible scholars, that the Jews were one tribe, only one tribe of 12. And we know that the Jews are everywhere in the world today, and they have been, and they've been scattered among the nations. And there are a number of them that live in the nation of Israel, the modern nation state of Israel today. And there are a number of them, large number of them, that live in New York City and London and other metropolitan areas of the world. But they're only one group of people. What about all the others? What happened to them? Most people that are associated with any of the churches of God have a pretty fair understanding of those folks. And they know that the greatest blessings were to be applied to the sons of Joseph, who were taken over by Jacob and said, well, these are going to be my sons now, and all the blessings, most of the blessings of God are going to be laid on the heads of Ephraim and Manasseh. So most people associated with the Church of God understand where those people landed through history. And that is a very, very interesting topic, but not the topic of today. Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28 are for all the 12 tribes of Israel, but probably affect those people to whom the greatest blessings were given. And in modern times, it's pretty easy to see who the greatest blessings have been applied to. Again, a topic for a different time. Let's take a look and explore the anatomy of some of the current fear that is gripping the world. From the encyclopedia, it says that fear is an intensely unpleasant emotion in response to perceiving or recognizing a danger or threat. Fear causes physiological changes that produce behavioral reactions such as mounting an aggressive response or fleeing the threat. Fear in human beings may occur in response to a certain stimulus occurring in the present, or in anticipation or expectation of a future threat perceived at a risk to oneself. And we can see how this is applied to the coronavirus, because it has been so all-encompassing. And it's been exacerbated above its relative importance, in my opinion. So please understand, just talking about an opinion being expressed here, which I'm free to do. Relative to the real threat, the external stimulus applied to all individuals has become so great because we're bombarded with it daily. And you're thinking, man, I want to stop hearing about this, and I'd love to stop talking about it. But I don't want to stop talking about it if it's going to be replaced by some even greater fear. What I'd like to do is try to help present some mechanisms that the Bible gives for coping with this kind of fear. And they're pretty simple. They're easily applied. It's just a reminder. But relative to the threat, relative to the actual threat, the perceived threat is much greater. That's what a phobia is. Now, most of the time, let's take arachnophobia, for instance. You could be lying out in the middle of a forest in a camp, and you could wake up to be absolutely covered with spiders. Now, hopefully that'll never happen to you, but you could actually, in your sleeping bag, you could actually be covered with spiders, and probably the real risk to you is relatively small, except if they were poisonous spiders or black widow spiders and they were all biting you. Then your risk is really great. But how often does that actually ever happen? And your fear of black widow spiders is probably relative to the actual risk that you have shows why that it's a phobia. It's not much. Or a brown recluse spider biting you. What are the chances of that happening very often through life? It's probably very, very low. And so not Steve Buchanan saying it, but the authors of a study done in Asia showed that the phobia associated with coronavirus was greatly elevated relative to the risk that is actually imposed. But when you hear about it constantly and you hear about the accentuated claims regarding it, it's hard not to be affected, right? It's hard not, and when you have friends and even friends in the church and friends who die of coronavirus, it's hard to ignore that the fact is that it is a present danger in our world. Besides all of that, we have been stimulated beyond the real threat, in my opinion. The fear responses arises from perception of danger leading to confrontation with or escape from avoiding the threat, to the point to where people have gone to ridiculous extremes of avoidance of others, or maybe the way they present themselves in public to avoid contracting the illness. And then society has had a response, for sure. Medical science has had a response. And, of course, never in our lives have we actually seen a response directed by governments, medical authorities, which has been so unified in its approach, despite language, despite differences in language and borders, and everything else. It's been kind of a universal response throughout the world, which has almost been identical. And I will state an opinion once again. It's okay for me to state an opinion. My opinion is, from a medical standpoint, from a medical point of view, the mitigation procedures, whichever ones you want to name, from beginning to slow the curve for 2 weeks or whatever, all the way through, have not really mitigated the actual problem, which seems to be relatively small. Let me qualify this, relative to the actual threat or the actual difficulty that is presented to society. So the mitigation procedures imposed on whole populations from A to Z seem to have prolonged the illness and may have, in fact, as some studies seem to indicate now, indicate that some of these mitigation procedures have elongated the nature or the length of the disease that a pandemic actually lasts, which is usually around 18 months. Now, the Spanish flu was something that none of us lived through. All we can do is read about it in the history books. It had a much higher kill rate. About 10% of everybody that caught the Spanish flu died from it. 90% live, and you said, well, I 90%, it sounds good, unless you're one of the 10% that actually died of it. Good records were not kept then, but the estimates range from 50 to 75 to 100 million died of the Spanish flu. Far more died of the Spanish flu than died in World War I. Of course, that was kind of the movement of troops around actually kind of, you know, sent the disease throughout the rest of the world. So that was a real high kill rate from a natural disease, a natural influenza. Very, very sad for all the families. And yet, because of the communications, the techniques were not very good at that time in the early part of the 20th century. It was not something that gripped the world as this one does seem to be doing now. So relative to the real danger, this one not so bad. I'm not de-escalating the danger, especially for those who've had family members who have died of this horrible man-made virus, which is unfortunate. The incompetence has also killed a lot of people as well, but that will get labeled as a coronavirus death. You know, lack of treatment in some cases. The intubation, which actually was responsible for even early on killing many thousands in several states in the United States, and so on and so forth. I think those are pretty well-known things. It's not really an opinion. I think it's been pretty well documented. But the point is, fear may be the new normal for the rest of our lives, even up until the time of Christ's return. So whether it's coronavirus, coronaphobia, or some other type of fear that may sometime replace it, we all need to understand how to cope with fear in this world. All the way up to the time of Jesus' return, in Luke 21 and verse 25, we read now, this is beyond this time, it's even beyond the Great Tribulation. It's going to be right on the eve of Jesus Christ's return. But just to give you an idea of things that are going to happen in the world, there will be signs in the sun, in the moon, and in the stars, and on the earth, distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them from fear, and the expectation of those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. So it does look like there's going to be a crescendo of fear, not because of this particular problem presently, but because of things that are going to happen just through prophecy. All right. Let's take a look at a historical example that is from the Bible. You'll find it in the book of Numbers. And it, from a point of view of the hysteria that can grip people, this is one that's even greater than the problem and the difficulties that we find right now. But this shows a lot of fear that is produced through wrong thinking, wrong reporting, wrong attitude, and those are the things that obviously we want to avoid, because you can see how this can just flow through a group of people. And I'll just set up the incidents by saying that Israel had come out of Egypt, 12 tribes, which would become 12 nations later on, through the united monarchy of Saul and David and Solomon. But these people were in their infancy then. There were various families that had descended now from Jacob, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And the story of entering into the promised land is a familiar one with people, even if they don't understand the Bible, because they probably have seen the Ten Commandments. So they've probably seen that movie. And in verse 1 of chapter 13, it says, "The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I am going to give to the children of Israel. From each tribe of their fathers you shall send a man, every one a leader among them." The captains of the nations, the creme de la creme, the top people, the most capable people of each of the 12 tribes. And they're enumerated here. All of their names are written down for you to see. All the individuals are from their tribes, actually, are there to see. The individuals' names are listed. In verse 16, it says, "These are the names of the men whom Moses sent to spy out the land. And Moses called Hoshea, the son of Nun, Joshua. Then Moses sent them out to spy the land of Canaan and said to them, go up this way into the south and go up to the mountains and see what the land is like, whether the people who dwell in it are strong or weak, few or many." Just a good strategy. Let's understand what we're going to. We know that God is going to give us this land. There are people that are living in it. But verse 20, "Whether land is rich or poor, whether there are forests there or not, be of good courage and bring some of the fruit of the land." This was very similar in reading about the travels of Lewis and Clark. And when I lived in South Dakota and lived in the area close by to where they had come through, and I think I've talked about this at one time before, how living in South Dakota gave me a sense of their discovery of the Louisiana Purchase, which Jefferson had bought from Napoleon. Napoleon needed money. We gave them money for the Louisiana Purchase and, you know, the greatest land sale of all time, and then the Gadsden Purchase after that. But reading of the account of those men, it was very, very similar. They went to explore, they were more than 12, but they went to explore the rest of what would become the United States, and they brought samples back, and they had diaries, they documented everything that they went through, and it was overcoming some of the irrational fear of the late 1700s and the early 1800s when people didn't know what was west of the Rockies, and when there were reports, all fictional as we know now, that there were woolly mammoths and dinosaurs still in the Wild West at that time. And those were the myths that were associated. So the idea is ancient, right? Going into the land to find out what it was actually like. Let's just take a look. Be of good courage. Bring some of the fruit of the land. Now the time of the season was the first ripe grapes. So they went up and they spied out the land from the wilderness of Zin as far as Rehob, near the entrance of Hamath. And they went up through the south and came to Hebron, a bunch of other places. Verse 23, "Then they came down to the valley of Eshcol and cut down there a branch with one cluster of grapes that they carried. They carried it between them on a pole, and they brought some of the pomegranates and the figs. And so they found a land of plenty," which shouldn't surprise anybody. Verse 26, "Now they departed and came back to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the children of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh." Interesting point that this wilderness area that they were in, that they were ready to go into the land, was the area very likely that we call Petra today. They were massed in that particular area that may have looked a lot differently back then. They may have had more vegetation. It's virtually a desert now. But that's where God had brought them. When you see the words Paran and Kadesh, and Israel kind of circled around there for 40 years and went through that area, but that was the area that we would call, or that is known in modern history today, as Petra. "So they brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. Then they told him and said, we went to the land where you sent us, and truly it flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. But this seemed to be the consensus of opinion mentioned in verse 28. Nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there." Anaks were giants. And so they were very tall people. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south. The Hittites, the Jebusites, and the Amorites dwell in the mountains. The Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the banks of the Jordan. And so they're setting up this problem of the land. And they detailed everything that they saw, and it was an accurate description of what they encountered, you know, the good with all the fruit that they saw and all the plenty of the land. But what did they leave out in this other explanation? What did they leave out of the equation? God. Bingo. They left God out of the issue here, out of the equation. But then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it." But the men who had gone up with him said, "We're not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we." It seems as though once they got back, they didn't have a little committee of 12 and say, "Okay, how are we going to do this?" Because this seems to me to be quite a surprise to Caleb and to Joshua. The men who had gone up with him said, "We're not able to go up against the people, for they're stronger than us." And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people whom we saw in it are men of great stature." Well, not everybody. There were the giants, but that wasn't everybody. There we saw the giants, the descendants of Anak, came from giants, and we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were there in their sight. So the upshot is the hysteria began. Now, because of the close proximity of the people together, they didn't need CNN or MSNBC or ABC, CBS, NBC to spread a lot of bad news. It just went through the congregation like wildfire. And people lost sight of everything except for a few. Moses, Aaron, Caleb, Joshua that we know of, a few others. And the mass hysteria prevailed. And the fear was so great that it ruled the day. So the people of the area were formidable, but they had left God out of the equation, these 10 spies that gave a false report. So as a result of that, the punishment that God gave was that they weren't going to go in. They would not have the blessing of going into the land at that particular time, just shortly after leaving Egypt. Nope. They were going to rot in the wilderness, most of them, except as it says in chapter 14 and verse 28, God told Moses, "Say to them, as I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will do to you. The carcasses of you who have complained against me shall fall in the wilderness. All of you who were numbered according to your entire number from 20 years old and above, except for Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun, you shall by no means enter the land which I swore I would make you dwell in. But your little ones, whom you said would be the victims going into that land, I will bring in, and you shall know the land which, and they shall know the land which you have despised. But as for you, your carcasses shall fall in this wilderness, and your sons shall be shepherds in the wilderness 40 years. And bear the brunt of your infidelity until your carcasses are consumed in the wilderness. According to the number of the days in which you spied out the land, 40 days for each day, you shall bear your guilt 1 year, namely 40 years. You shall know my rejection." That's where we get the day for the year principle. It's often used in prophecy, and that's applied in this particular case. Now, be wary. This is to us as individuals. Be wary of bringing a false or evil report or an unrealistic report. Now, you'll just have to be wise enough to understand in the future how this should be applied to you. Okay? I'm not saying every time you're discouraged, this will apply to you. It doesn't mean that every time you're negative, this will be applied to you. It doesn't mean any time that you suffer from some kind of phobia that this will be applied to you. You'll just have to know when will it apply to you, and I can't define that in every single circumstances. But notice verse 36. Now the men whom Moses sent to spy out the land, who returned and made all the congregation complain against him by bringing a bad report of the land, these very men who brought the evil report about the land died by a plague before the Lord. God just wiped them out, all 10 of them, but Joshua and Caleb lived. They died immediately. And in verse 39, then Moses told the words to all the children of Israel, and the people mourned greatly. And guess what they did? They decided, okay, now we want to go in. God says you're not going in, so they decided that they were going to go in, a segment of them, and they were destroyed in battle. So God makes up his mind. You better not go against it then. But they did, and they died in battle. So be wary of an evil report, and you don't want to be the person that is bringing a wrong or a false report that contradicts what God has promised. That's where you have to be discerning. One of the constants of coronavirus fear or coronaphobia is that it has swept the world and has been constantly stoked and accentuated by media and government. In this way, I would not want to be some of the proponents who've actually been wise enough to know that they're in on the case, right? That they are aware of the real dangers versus the false dangers, but they may have a hidden agenda in bringing these false reports or accentuated reports or exaggerated misinformation. You'll notice that in the world today, they have applied some of the what are called the rules for radicals. If you want to be radical, you take what you are doing and then you accuse somebody else of doing that very same thing. And it's been repeated in the last 5 years in a number of different ways, which I won't go into, but you're probably sharp enough that you have picked up on it. You find what you are doing that you know is wrong, and then you apply it to the other side. This is why I've been so against in the last few years about the attitude of relative morality that is applied equally to everyone. And that's been a kind of a very innocent and naive way of, frankly, the Church of God through the years of viewing the world by assuming that all sides are wrong or assigning the same moral depravity to each side. Let's come up with a ridiculous example, okay? If you are to tell me that somebody who is a leader, maybe let's call him a politician, is an endorser of baby murder or abortion, and just take that one issue, and they are firmly for that, they are firmly for abortion, and then try to explain to me that that person is just the same or as bad as the person who may be a leader or a politician who is pro-life. And if you just take that one example, I'm going to say you're nuts, because one is better than the other. It's better to be for life than it is for death. Okay, so moral relativism, or the moral equivalency rather, to shake out, not relativism, but moral equivalence applied to both sides of an equation is wrong. It's diabolically wrong. And sometimes we have been guilty of that in the past. But one of the constants is that this particular problem has been constantly stoked and accentuated. Again, I would not want to be in the shoes of somebody who actually is in the know and realizes that as a leader of this world, that they have caused a lot of this phobia to continue. And there are people out there that are exactly like that. Do your own research. Why is it happening? Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 2. Why is it happening? This is maybe, for some people, it may be just too simplistic an explanation. But along with the devil knows that his time is short, Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 2 says, in which you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience. The greatest work that the devil does is with people who do not respect the law of God. Now that, I'll finish up with this, that gives me some hope for the world, because the devil does his greatest work in people who are disobedient to law and godly authority. And by law, I mean the Ten Commandments and the expansion of the Ten Commandments and the application of God's law. You know, there are a lot of people that do believe in the law of God. They're not a part of our church, but they believe in it. And we should be supporters of those individuals, and at least that attitude. But the God of this world is mentioned in he's mentioned in 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 4. 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 4, it says, whose minds the God of this age has blinded, who do not believe. Now again, he does his greatest work in people that are absent of the law of God. Now, just so happens in this nation, we were founded upon the law of God. Now, we've seen through many, many decades, 7, 8 decades at least, the kind of decadence that is taught within the university and school system. And it seems to have come to a crisis even in the last few years. At least one of the things coronavirus has actually shown and exposed to many parents, and they're very upset about it, is some of the things that are being taught to children and have been taught for many, many years. It's just gradually escalating, where people are taught to be divided and people are taught to hate one another, taught that they're bad and they're evil and they're wrong. And that has been something exposed, and a lot of people are very, very upset about that. Maybe one positive is wakened some people up to one degree or another. But 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 4 exposes the God of this world. People are blinded if they do not believe, lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine on them. 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 12 also accentuates this. These are really kind of memory scriptures for most of you. I realize that. 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 12, these help explain why what is happening in the world today. 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 12, now we have received, Paul's speaking to the church in Corinth, not the spirit of the world, which was spoken of in Ephesians 2 and verse 2, a spiritual essence. You can't see it. You can't touch it. You can't feel it. You can't see it. It's spiritual. It's invisible, but it is a force that is there to be reckoned with. It is a spirit of this world, and it comes from the devil. And it can overtake people if they're not obedient, if they are not moral, if they are not founded in the law of God. And it, of course, will reach a crescendo as time goes on. It'll be worse and worse and worse and worse. But those who have rejected the law of God, and Romans chapter 1 says there's a certain segment of the world that has absolutely rejected authority of God in their lives, they are the ones that are susceptible and most susceptible to the fears and the phobias that are guided and directed by the God of this world, the spirit of this world, which now works in the sons of disobedience. If you remember the last part of that verse in Ephesians 2, works excessively in the sons of disobedience. you have a natural protection, even if you're not a member of the Church of God. You have a bit of protection because of your allegiance to God, your allegiance to His law, and your understanding that there is good and bad, and that you want to be on the side of good. You don't want to be on the side of evil. You don't want to be on the side of the people who know better and are actually a part of the deception process that is taking place. So be wary of evil reports, which are exaggerated. Just an awareness. Be aware of the God of this world and be aware of what He can do. And it is very powerful. And I think that the expression of this particular phobia, the expression of this particular virus relative to the actual danger that it presents, although I'm not discounting any danger that is there, because it is there. And I've lost loved ones. I've lost family. I've lost people that have died from this, okay? So we all know that, but relative to the actual danger, there are people who are responsible for promulgating this because fear helps make governments more in control. It creates an atmosphere in which there can be more control and dominion exercised over people. Take a look at what's happening in some of the English-speaking nations of the world, in Canada, in the United Kingdom. I think I might need the rest of this. In the United Kingdom, in Australia, in New Zealand, take a look at what is happening in those nations. It's incredible, and in this nation as well. The antidote for all of this is fear God. Psalm 56 and verse 3, there are hundreds and hundreds of passages about fearing God and putting the fear of God in your life, the correct fear, the honor, respect, respect for His commands, respect for His being. Psalm 56 in verse 3, whenever I am afraid, I will trust in You. In God, I will praise His word. In God, I have put my trust. I will not fear. What can flesh do to me? I'm not saying it's a panacea for every single problem in life, but it's a good start. The proper fear of God. Matthew 10 and verse 28. Christ said, do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul, but rather fear Him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. There, of course, is the ultimate authority of God to which we are all responsible. And life and death are a part of the human existence. But the real fear is in disobedience to God. So can you eliminate fear altogether? Probably not, to be honest. There's going to be times of fear in the future. But you can redirect it. You can redirect a response to it. You can follow the guidelines of the Bible, turning to 2 Timothy chapter 1. You can kind of redirect the resources that you have available to combat fear. The title was Conquer Fear. I'm not sure that we can always conquer every fear. And fear is going to be a natural consequence of the unknown and the uncertain and the difficulty of life. And it can be a very healthy reaction. That's why I say you probably can't overcome and conquer it totally. But you can redirect it. 2 Timothy chapter 1, pretty simple stuff, really, when you get down to it. 2 Timothy chapter 1. Therefore, I remind you to stir up the gift of God, which is in you through the laying on of hands. For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. Fear doesn't come from God. Fear can be directed with the power of God's Holy Spirit. You can stir that up, and you can face fear with the confidence that God gives you. And then, of course, I don't know that this sermon would be complete without mentioning Philippians chapter 4. And in verse 8, the reason that this is so important, and we have really emphasized it in the past year a lot, which is good, is that our minds are so filled up by the media presence that we're exposed to, whether it's social media presence, whether it's the media presence of the TV and the radio and the reporting. There's just no way you can, probably you shouldn't, shut yourself off from all society, because they're near in the dark to some extent. You kind of have to filter. I think you have to be have great discretion about what you allow into your mind and how much of certainly the mainstream news media you allow into your mind, because it's designed to capture, captivate, and direct you in a wrong place, I fully believe. But with all of that going on, it is necessary for a Christian to sit back and think. And it was brought out during the time of the sermonette that there is a time to be thankful, and that's really every day. We had a national day of Thanksgiving. And I think, judging by what I see, there are a lot of people who are very thankful to God for the blessings of this nation still. That's a good thing. But it says in Philippians 4 and verse 8, "Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there's any virtue, if there's anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things." I believe that a part of every individual's day should be spent in meditation and thankfulness to God for the blessings that we have. It's a way to combat the wrong influence that is there. Now, there's also a time, I'm going to cite this passage, which you well know. There's also a time in Ezekiel chapter 9 and verse 4, it says that God places a special mark. He separates those who sigh and cry for the abominations that are taking place in the land. And you know that particular passage. And I believe that that is a part of our responsibility to this world as well. If you read that chapter, you'll find that the problems eventually become the problems of society, and the world becomes so great that God, you know, in this chapter is sending angels in to kill people for their wickedness, for their absolute depravity and wickedness. And I don't think we're at that stage yet. We could be in the future, and we will be in the future. There are a lot of greater issues that I believe plague our society, and a lot of people are kind of unaware of them, kind of put them aside, don't think about them very, very much. But in our modern world, I think about the millions and millions that are killed every year through abortion. And something that is not widely reported but is happening within our world, the child kidnapping and pedophilia of little children, sexual slavery that children are sold into, are far greater criminal acts that are done by people who have no understanding of God and how he will punish that at some point in the future. It's not something that you really want to spend a lot of time with and looking at, actually, but it's something that is real and it's happening, and it's very, very unfortunate. Now, there is a backlash that is happening in many nations against the hysteria that is, you won't see much of it in the news media, but there is a backlash that is occurring that could be encouraging. I'm not going to place my trust in that. I place my trust in God. But people have a desire to be free. And some of the areas that have been most locked down, people are beginning to rebel. And you won't hear about it. You won't see it much on the news. But people are reacting to the coronaphobia of the world. They're not happy about it. And I'm not saying that, you know, go out and demonstrate in the streets or anything like that. That's not my encouragement. I'm just saying that when you see it happening, and if a news agency, like one of the popular ones that have the things, they begin, or the acronyms are ones that you recognize very much. If they say that there were 500 people at a protest, which is protesting against this government or that government, there probably was 10,000. And if they say there were thousands, they may have been millions in the streets of Paris or in Rome or in Sydney, Australia, or someplace else. So you can't really believe it, but that is some of the backlash that is happening because people want to be free. And I'm not sure how far it'll go or how long they'll allow that to develop, but people are demonstrating against tyranny in a world that has been free for the most part for many, many generations. And there are a lot of people who want to be obedient to God. They just need to be instructed as to how to do it. John chapter 4 and verse 34 is a passage that I'll close with today that I think that maybe we haven't placed as much emphasis on as we could. John 4 and verse 34, Jesus said to them, "My food is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work. Do you not say there are still 4 months and then comes the harvest? Behold, I say to you, lift up your eyes and look at the fields, for they are already white for harvest." Time could be very shortly that a great harvest of people to help them to understand and to understand and respond to God is yet ahead of us. Throughout our history in the modern era of the Church of God, I think we have unfortunately been the victims. This is an opinion. Did I say opinion? Okay, an opinion. Opinion stated. Let's get that clear. Throughout our history in the modern era of the Church of God, I think we have unfortunately been the victims of an accentuation of an us versus them mentality. The church, the world. The church good, the world evil. If the fields are white with harvest, then them are soon to be us. We've got to be welcoming to them. Jesus said in John 16 and verse 33 that I have overcome the world. We need to overcome the world as well. And overcoming fear and overcoming the paranoia of this world is a part of our responsibility by applying a few well-known strategies of staying close to God, fearing God, placing things in perspective, and looking forward to the future. We can manage the fear of this present evil world and be ready to help mankind.